Hi, this is Joran Gargello, and you're listening to Improv Nerd with Jimmy Curran.
Jimmy Curran's a nerd. Jimmy Curran's an improv nerd. Jimmy Curran's a nerd.
Oh, hey, everybody, this is Jimmy Curran, and you're listening to another episode of Improv Nerd, sponsored by Dad's Garage. Now, Dad's Garage, for 20 years, has provided Atlanta with top-notch comedic plays, improvised soap operas, and competitive comedy. And Dad's Garage draws in nationally known celebrities and comedians like Colin Mochrie, Fred Willard, and Scott Adsit, all regularly join the Dad stage for improvised hijinks. And if you're fans of Archer and Adult Swim, you'll recognize several Dad's cast members featured in these popular shows. Dad's Garage is located at the intersection of awesome, funny, and bizarre in Atlanta. So, you want to see a show at Dad's Garage? All you need to do is use the promo code ImprovNerd for 25% off any improv show. Dad's Garage has shows every Thursday, Friday, and Saturday nights at 10:30 p.m. So this is your chance to get some really cheap tickets. All you need to do is go to dadsgarage.com to learn more about the company, to buy tickets, or to submit a cake recipe. Currently, Dad's Garage performs out of Seven Stages Theater in Little Five Points. For more information and directions to the theater, go to dadsgarage.com. Also, back by popular demand, I will be offering my two-person scene tune-up workshop Saturday, August 22nd here in Chicago at Stage 773. So if you want to fine-tune your two-person scenes to make yourself an even better long-form improviser, sign up today. This workshop is limited to 14 people. All you need to do is go to my slick new website at jimmycurran.com. That's jimmycurran.com. We have another great episode of Improv Nerd for you today. Our guest is Joran Gargello. He is a member of Revolver, Felt, and The Scene at I.O. Chicago. He's also performed with Rainbow Deli at CIC, and he's just an incredible teacher and improviser, and he really is a true original. The thing I really enjoyed about improvising with him is he pulled me out of my comfort zone, and as you know, that is not an easy thing to do. We talked to him about starting out improvising when he was 17 in North Carolina, and how at the age of 30, which of course in improv years is almost close to retirement, how he decided to leave North Carolina and move to Chicago. We also got to discuss some of the great improv groups he's gotten to perform with, like Revolver and Rainbow Deli. And he tells us why he thinks some of his best improvising has been done with Rainbow Deli. Before we get to the episode with Joran, you guys know I've been taking this stand-up comedy class, and I've wanted to do it for a long time, like my whole life. And last Tuesday, we had our final student performance, where we get to perform our 5 minutes of material, or we like to say in stand-up, our tight five, that we've been working on for the last 6 weeks. In these kind of performance situations, I have a history of choking. All I need is the slightest bit of pressure, and I will choke. So the six of us from class all meet a half hour at the theater before the show. And I'm feeling calm. I know this is coming as a total surprise to you guys. No anxiety, no fear, no pressure. Until Ricky, the teacher, announces the running order. And he announces the order. And he says, I'm going sixth. I'm going last. Which is really good because you kind of feel like you're headlining. And now I'm thinking to myself, oh my God, here comes the pressure. Here comes the expectations. Somebody thinks that I'm pretty good and that they want me to go last, and now I'm going to choke. So Ricky opens the show. He does about 10 minutes, and then everyone does their 5 minutes, and then it comes to me. And I get up there, and the adrenaline is going, and I want to tell you something. I killed. I slayed. I did such a great job. It was just so much fun to be up there again. I felt great. And, you know, it was great. It was so much fun. I 5 minutes was like, it wasn't a tight five. It was more like a kind of a, you know, a kind of a fat seven. But it was just so much fun. And afterwards, I know I did a good job because my wife said I did a good job. And she can be a very hard critic sometimes, which is not her fault. She gets it from her parents. But I just had such a blast. And I just wanted to share the good news with you guys that I killed it. I did a great job at stand-up. All right. So hopefully there's going to be more opportunities for me because I just enjoyed it so much. Enough about me. Here you guys go. Here's the Joran Gargello episode. Enjoy.
Jimmy's a nerd. He's a nerd. Oh, yeah. Jimmy's a nerd. He's a nerd.
Thank you so much for doing this because Absolutely. We've been trying to do this for a while.
Yeah, yeah.
And it always coincides with rehearsal.
Yeah, with the Revolver rehearsal. So I try and, make a commitment not to miss that when possible. So, thank goodness for the Birth of Our Nation. It gave me an opportunity to be here. Yeah.
Now, you've moved around a lot as a kid and for your mom's job. And how did you think moving around a lot affected your personality?
I'm naturally sort of an introvert anyway, and so moving a lot kind of kept cutting me off from sort of having a lot of friends. Every time I'd make a move, it was like at a significant developmental stage, and so my friends wound up being books largely. So
what did you read as a kid?
My father read to me a lot when I was little, and it was like Tolkien and Douglas Adams and Daniel Pinkwater, and so those informed a lot of my sensibilities.
Tolkien, I know, is The Hobbit. What are the other two?
Douglas Adams is Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Okay.
And Daniel Pinkwater is a series of amazing sort of Vonnegut with more positivity children's writer, sort of,
It's very good niche.
Absolutely. I think he's my primary influence on how I look at performance, really. So,
in what way?
In sort of like the fantastic is something that we should take the opportunity to engage in, but it should also feel real and visceral, and it's okay to have fun. So really.
Now you describe yourself as a weird introverted kid.
Yeah, yeah.
And what did you do besides reading for fun?
It was largely just reading. I mean, I read and I drew, and that was a lot of, I mean, like any kid, I played outside with my brother and kind of, did kid stuff, but I would say I was pretty bookish, so whether that was book in hand or drawing or reading comic books or any of that stuff. I remember walking home from middle school actually reading a book while I was walking home. And
now, do kids make fun of you because you read?
Yeah, some. I mean, one a guy who turned into a really good friend of mine rolled up next to me and made fun of me because I was reading a book as I was walking.
What do they say to people that are reading?
It's mostly a sarcastic, "Hey, reading a book?" It's like, "Yes, I am, and I can tell that your tone is mockery, but you have correctly identified my tone." So.
Were you kind of a smart-ass kid?
No. I mean, in high school, I think I got to be a little bit more sort of more of a principled anarchist about things. I've always... The thing that my parents told me is, as a kid, like on the playground, I always wanted people to get together and like be friendly and cooperate. But I usually also wound up sort of being on the outside edge. I remember being in the Michael Jackson fan club, which was like five kids in the elementary school class of like 25. And because we really loved Thriller, and it was like me and four girls, and then there was like everyone else in the class got mad because it was sort of like, it was small town Wisconsin, and they became, somewhat like the Duran Duran or U2 fan club that existed strictly to like run down on us on the playground as we were talking about Michael Jackson and like make fun of us and then run away. So it's like that has happened a lot over the course of my life, too.
but your parents took you to a comedy sports show when you're 17.
Yeah, when I was 17.
What did you love about that show when you saw it?
It was funny. I mean, it was really funny, and it was very free. And, as I was growing up, my dad sort of shared a lot of great things with me, including, probably when I was 10 or 11, he played the first Firesun Theater album I'd ever heard. Mm-hmm. So he played that for me, and he played like Spike Jones, and we watched a lot of SCTV, so I had an awareness of kind of like ridiculous, funny comedy, and to see it in the same room and realize it was kind of anyone could do it You know, and magnetic personalities exist not only kind of on the other side of a silver screen, but in a room with you, and you could maybe do it. It was just so much fun to see. I just wanted to, you know, that's probably the same kind of addicting feeling that we all get, where you just want to kind of, it jives with you intellectually, and you see the act of creation and the act of joy, you sort of want to see it again, and you want to be a part of that, you know? So that's, and at 17, I played a lot of Dungeons & Dragons up to that point, so it's like, oh, this is like Dungeons & Dragons, but funny and no dice, you know, like with people so standing
then,
up.
So then the next day, you take a workshop.
Yeah, for my, well, we went back after, I saw the show with my folks, and then I went back for my 17th birthday and took everybody. And one of my best friend, well, still to this day, one of my best friends, saw an ad for it and said, hey, we should do that. We should do that workshop. And I was, you know, I mean, I was very much less actualized in being able to be open about my introversion. So I was fairly terrified by it, but we did. We went and took a workshop, a free 8-week workshop. And
then, and you almost say, you say that comedy sports and doing improv helped you get over being an introvert.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I still am. I feel very awkward around people.
Well, how about right now?
Yeah, I mean, probably. Yeah, to some degree. But the thing is, I think probably everybody does. That is that's the doorway through which I was able to step.
Joran, I
know. You know. Yeah.
No, I feel it all the time.
Yeah. I mean, you don't stop feeling awkward when your energy source is personal reflection. You know, around other people. You don't start getting energy from other people, but you start to realize, you know, via empathy that everyone else also probably feels the same way to some degree, and how enabling it is to a positive experience if you just open yourself up and expose what your internal engine is. And so that's what I'm doing now. I kind of feel like, oh, well, we essentially are all the same, so I feel awkward, but we all feel awkward.
So after this, or after you do a show, will you? Mm-hmm. How will you, as an introvert, like recharge your battery?
Well, I mean, you know, as immediately after a show, it's sort of like coasting on the feeling of it, you know. And I actually think that, I mean, probably a lot of us that improvise have some degree of introversion, or at least a large, more than you'd expect. It's not a sea of extroverts with a few of us clinging to driftwood, you know? I mean, I would say it's probably at least half and half, and it's because, you know, sort of your internal engine for creation can be turned open, and it still feels like you're doing the thing that gives you energy, but you're doing it with other people, which feels like a very special and spiritual experience to have. And so often after shows, it's not like I feel depletion, unlike, you know, sort of in personal communication or any of that stuff. A show is a different animal entirely that kind of brings us all together, no matter what your kind of type is.
And then you do comedy sports for 13 years.
Yeah. I was at that comedy sports for 13 years.
And the thing about comedy sports is they really care about the audience.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. I mean, that's why if you want to take kids to see a show, take them to see a comedy sports show. Absolutely.
And then you come to Chicago and you do long form.
Mm-hmm.
How does your short form experience at comedy sports inspire you in your long form work?
Well, you know, I think that I do think short form is really important because it teaches you rhythm and game and a lot of like things that you're asked to do on occasion in long form shows, be that singing or sort of being put on the spot and doing sort of more of the mechanical things. So I think it's really worthwhile. But while I was still at that comedy sports and then comedy works, we were starting to play around a little bit with long form improvisation. And always the thing that was the most enjoyable to me was less the mechanics of the games that we would play and more sort of the creation of the moment of becoming a character or, you know, discovering relationship. And so for me, it was a lot of kind of natural evolution to what I wanted to do anyway. It's just kind of like trying to overcome some of my trained game instincts and realize, you know, be more comfortable with kind of space and engagement, you know, but I'll never escape kind of my clownishness. I never will.
So you're 30 years old. You're in North Carolina. You're doing comedy sports, which then changes to comedy works.
Mm-hmm.
And you're like, oh, should I go to Chicago or not? Because you know, 30 years old to start to move to Chicago is it's considered on the older side.
Yeah.
How did you decide to make that move?
I emailed a bunch of friends that were here already and asked them if I was too old.
And what'd they say?
No, not at all. Absolutely, you should do this. You know, it was, and they were right. I mean, you know, and that's a conversation that I have with folks all the time now. You know, in their 30s. Or, you know, late 20s or whatever, where they're worried about being too old. And it's kind of like, well, you're still alive. And, you're still alive. You're still a person. You still have, you know, an engagement with the experience of living. And so, you know, the panic that you're feeling is just hangover from being in your 20s, which is miserable. Don't worry. It gets better. You know, I mean, like, just do it.
And you also got an audition for Boom Chicago, which brought you here. And it was like...
That helped. I mean, that really helped.
In what way?
Well, it was, you know, there is that question of like, oh, well, I mean, maybe I've missed my window or maybe I am too old. But, you know, I guess maybe I was 28 at the time when that happened. And the friend that I began comedy sports with was at Boom Chicago already. I had like a job situation that seemed like it was in flux. And he said, well, why don't you audition for Boom? If it works out, you know, then you don't have to worry about getting another job. And I was like, yeah, what the hell, I will. So I flew up
to Chicago.
They were auditioning in New York and Chicago, and I flew to Chicago and just to take a wild shot at it. And of course, it's, you know, a lot of what they're looking at is short form, so I probably was very much in tune with the kind of thing that they want to see. But, you know, I went into their whole audition process and I got a call back from that. And
how'd you feel about that?
Good. Really, I mean, good. Great. It sort of affirmed this notion of like, oh, well, maybe actually I do know somewhat what I'm doing. You know, that I can be this, you know, sort of rough, weird, you know, pagan from the out country and come in and you know, show enough natural value that would be worth consideration, you know. And I did that callback with, you know, there, I don't know, you know, hundreds of people down to 20 or whatever, and I did the callback, and just a lack of knowledge on my part, but I really walked out of that callback thinking, oh shit, they're gonna hire me and I am not financially solvent to move to Amsterdam. And then they called me and were like, no, we're not gonna hire you. So, but it was like, it was still, you know, I like saw people that didn't get callbacks that I had seen playing weekend shows at IO when I had visited, and it was very much like a okay, well, on an even playing field where nobody knows anyone, me in a relatively untrained state for what I want to be doing could stand shoulder to shoulder with those folks, you know. And in my callback, I was in a callback with Steve Waltine. I don't know if he remembers that, but I felt very awkward about it when I moved here and he was a big wheel. And I was like, oh, yeah, I was in that callback with you and neither of us got it. To this day, I'm not sure that he, like, actually... you know, consciously remembers that.
And so that gave you the confidence to move to Chicago?
Yeah, I think so, you know, because it got to the point where everyone that I'd come up with kind of had moved away or had stopped improvising, and I didn't want to stop improvising. It's the thing that is the most core of my being, really. And so, you know, I reached a point there where I was kind of like in a pivotal position at this theater, and I didn't know if the respect I had was due to status or due to actually being good, and I wanted more opportunity to pursue stuff. So, you know, spent a lot of time, you know, I still remember crying in a grocery store parking lot telling my brother I was going to move away. You know, it was the first time I was not going to be in the same city as him, you know, and going to lunch with the owner of the theater and saying, look, hey, I got to move away, and how hard that was. Because, you know, I love that theater. I love those people. I bring teams back every year to have a weekend to play there, you know. So, but it was the choice had to be made, and so I was kind of like, man, change cascades across to you. You know, it's like good change, bad change, and so if I may as well actually have agency and make a change that I want to do.
Well, so. And the other thing is, you've always had like a job in the technical field, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So when you came to Chicago, you could get a job in the technical field?
Yeah, I actually, you know, when I told my boss, hey, I need to move to Chicago because of what's most important to me, he said, okay, that's fine. Well, you'll work remote. And so I worked remotely for the company I was working for in North Carolina for 4 years before I sort of transitioned into freelancing and then into working for companies. You know, now I go down to the loop every day.
And you still work 40 hours a week?
Yeah.
How do you balance that, teaching at CIC, teaching at I.O., performing at CIC, performing at I.O.?
My mantra is that I'm tired and happy. You know, it's exhausting, you know, and I think that probably there are times when, you know, when I lay my bones down and pass out, you know, it's because it's like, oh, wow, I'm operating in a state of exhaustion all the time. But all this stuff is important, very important, you know. I don't like the notion of decay, of having been the best version of myself that I can be. And so a lot of that drives me forward. So I may not have the natural sort of like physical spring in my step, but I have had a lot more mental practice at having mental stamina.
You ever thought, like, okay, I've got this technical thing down. You're very well respected in the improv community, not only as a teacher, but as a performer. You know what? I don't need this day job anymore.
You know, it's one of those things where I really appreciate what it gives me, you know? I mean, I enjoy it, and it staves off decay. You know, my mind has to combat a completely different set of things in my day job that are worthwhile. You know, I'm trying to be kind of a classical man of letters and be a scientist and an artist. And so that being the case, both those things have to be present. And eventually, decay will happen and one of them will fall away, and that will be my day job, and I'll work at a grocery store and still be improvising. But, you know, that's, I haven't had to come to that point yet.
When you started at the I.O., you saw a lot of shows.
Yeah,
and you took classes, and you said Dan Bacadal was one of your favorite teachers.
Oh, he's the best teacher I've ever had in my life, and my favorite improviser.
Great.
Absolutely.
And tell us why he's your favorite improviser and favorite teacher.
Well, he's extremely present. So, you know, and there's no one who, as acerbic as he may be, there's nobody that has more integrity. You know, he has the most integrity of any performer I've ever met. You know, I mean, when he was my level 3 teacher, it was coming off him punching the wall at Second City and leaving Second City because, you know, they weren't handling the material that he generated in the way that that he appreciated. So he went back to I.O. and started teaching at I.O. And, you know, shortly after, the next level is when he got hired by The Daily Show. But there was no air of that. You know, the air of his intensity came from the fact that he was just so present. And he was so focused on each of us as students, and he made sure that what he was teaching was clear, and he was fair and critical and supportive of all of us. So it really, you know, really pushed us forward. It made us bond as a group. You know, I mean, the group of people that I was with in classes with since the first level, we were all already kind of tacitly a group, but it was that level that sort of made us realize that we had a special opportunity to be together, and he was the advocate that made that happen.
One thing you learned from him that you still hold on to?
the thing that is funny to me now is how the things that we learn always have value. The technical pieces that we learn are not things that you sort of do while you're a student and then you can forget about them, but rather that craft is important, and craft is always important, because he would talk to us where, you know, we would have, I mean, I'm sure this sounds extremely eerie to any students that I have, but at I.O. now, but we would have a level 3 class on a Thursday night with him, and then we would go downstairs and watch his train wreck.
Which is his show with Ed Furman.
Ed Furman, yeah.
It was a two-person.
Yeah, two-person show, fantastic show, unbelievably great. And Dan was so flexible, or, you know, Ed's so specific, and Dan would just flex to whatever was called for and have so much integrity in it. But he would talk to us about the things that had happened in the show where he was having some level of like panic or awareness of, he had just talked to us about the necessity for this thing and had talked about it passionately, and then he got into a show and realized that he was on a danger cusp of not fulfilling the contract that he had put before us, and then showed us, you know, taught us how to execute, showed us how to execute, and didn't take it for granted that it was going to happen, but actually put the work in to do it, you know, so integrity, constant work, you know, it actually does matter, you know.
And so you're at I.O., you go through the program and you get on Revolver.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And this is a legendary Herald team. And they've been around
Weirdly, yes.
Why do you say weirdly so?
Well, just because, you know, I mean, it's like anything where you receive some level of recognition, it seems like it's a big deal from the outside, and from the inside, you're just trying to not let the rain slip out of your hand and tumble into the snow, let the sleigh ride over you and sever your legs, you know? I mean, it's like...
So you guys have been doing this for 10 years, right?
Yeah, 10 years. Our 10-year anniversary will be in October this year, and our 10-year playing anniversary will be in January.
Why do you guys think you've been so successful?
Well, we take the work seriously, and, just as on a personal level, I think there's a premium for getting better, trying to stay better. I think that we feel that way as a team, too. I mean, we had the best Herald mind that I've ever had the pleasure to be around in Mike Enriquez that coached us, and not only coached us on stage, but gave us a real discipline for what it meant to be a part of a team and the value of it and why you needed to pay in fully to the experience. And when he stopped coaching us and we continued as a team, rather than sort of being like, oh, well, now it's our time to take it easy and just be a vet team and coast, because of the discipline he impressed on us, we put a premium on finding another coach that we thought had something to share with us. And we got Pat Rayner to coach us, and he coached us for a number of years and was fantastic. And when he stopped coaching us, we did the same thing, and we went and got Jared Jeffries, and he's been fantastic coaching us too. So, you know, I mean, it's not a lot of teams that are around for 3 years that are still around that actually rehearse weekly with, like, a point of view for why they're rehearsing.
And it's so interesting because you guys really take this rehearsal every week very seriously.
Very seriously.
We've also tried to get Farrell Walsh on the
sure.
show,
yeah.
who's on the team, and he's
yep.
like, I can't do it. Improv Nerd falls on the same time we do it. Does everyone have that level of commitment?
To some degree. I would say that we were in a plus minus 20%, you mm-hmm. know, on that level of commitment.
How important is that?
Extremely important. Mm-hmm. Extremely important, because it's a reminder that it's not just a, you know, it's easy to be like, oh, what a privilege, we can play, you know, but you're going to play, you know, when you go to play, to actually remember that it has value enough that you work for it is very reinforcing, especially as, you know, we all evolve individually as players, and, you know, our personal philosophies, you know, kind of deviate slightly because we grow as people, to have a check-in where we decide what we're going to do as a group is extremely important.
And you were also on a team called at CIC, mm-hmm. which is chemically imbalanced comedy.
Yes. Well, it used to be. We're trying not to say that anymore because it's a dumb name.
Okay. But we're going by CIC.
Just going by CIC.
This is like KFC. We don't say Kentucky Fried Chicken anymore.
CIC.
We say KFC.
Yeah. It's we posted it to Facebook, and my mom just couldn't stop guessing at what the letters stood for. And
right.
It's like, no, it's just CIC. And she's like, no, I think it's Chicago Improv Comedy. It's like, well, it's probably the best acronym.
And you were on a team called Rainbow Deli.
Yeah.
With
yeah.
some of the people that were on Revolver.
Yep, yeah,
and
absolutely.
You say that Rainbow Deli was the best thing you've ever done. Can
yeah.
you explain?
I think it's, yeah, as I mean, I've had I've lived a charmed life, from being able to be in comedy sports in Raleigh in the 90s, to being able to be with the Chicago Sachet Company, my class group, to being able to be on Revolver and Purple Rain, and which is my team now, and Rainbow Deli, and putting Thank You, and a number of teams that, you know, now Boyish and Felt and, you know, Dinner Bell, all these teams that have meant a lot to me. And I just think that any one of them would have been an enormously gratifying experience. So I, you know, I can't downplay that. But then to sort of say, well, my best work was on this ensemble, does make it really special. I think it was the best because it was a full ensemble, and I prefer ensemble work. I think it's more complicated, but your range is greater. And I thought that we generally sort of worked together so well and did unusual, unexpected things with our shows. And we kind of had devised, you know, a way that we were playing that had a sort of a lyrical element to it that kind of had form but freed us from, you know, sort of the more rigid and mechanical things that can happen when, you know, when you play a Herald, it's so ingrained exactly what the mechanism is, even though it invites you to deviate from that as necessary in the show. Still, there is some level of structure that you're going to see every time that can lead to a little bit of inflexibility. But I think we had a form that functioned such that even though there was an underlying form, it was a little bit more sensual, I guess.
You know? It sounds like it really played to your strengths.
Yeah, I think so. You know, I mean, maybe it's just I thought it was the best because it made me feel the best. You know, who knows? Maybe it was the third worst thing I've ever done. But sure.
All right, so hopefully we're going to do like the first best thing you've ever done.
Oh, sure.
All right.
Yeah. Okay.
And we're going to improvise right now. What would you like to do?
It seems like maybe in this context just a single scene would be fine, but if... you know, if tangents come up, I don't see why.
Great, and if tangents come up, how are we going to handle them?
Why don't we do the age-old technique of if we realize there's just some great thing that we can pop out to, let's just change our.
Okay,
you know,
great.
Do a stage picture, but you know, it probably won't even be necessary.
Okay, but it's good to know.
Yeah,
right. We're going to take a suggestion.
Okay.
Okay.
Great.
How do you want to start this?
It has been entertaining me, perhaps indulgently so lately, with an improv savvy audience to ask for the suggestion of a brief description of an improv scene they would like to see improvised.
Okay. Could we get a brief description of an improv scene that you would like to see improvised? That kind of puts them on the spot, doesn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
Because I'd be like,
oh,
I got to come up with something funny. But it doesn't matter.
No, it doesn't matter at all. Okay. We're not going to do what you tell us to do.
Great. Yeah.
I mean, that's the. But, you know, we're being put on the spot, so it's only fair that you pay your blood in.
Right. So can we get a suggestion of it? Yes.
A company that's slowly shutting down because they have to outsource their work.
A company that's slowly shutting down because they have to outsource their work. Now, you've gotten this suggestion. Uh-huh. I want to do that scene.
Great, which, yeah. Which,
okay. How are you processing it in your head?
My immediate feeling is like, well, you know, we have the benefit of general context now, so we don't have to necessarily work that hard on context. We will probably, mm-hmm. It'll probably fall out. But, you know, I like feeling things and becoming things rather than kind of like...
What does that look like? Because I'm willing to feel and become things, too.
Okay, well, my immediate feeling is like, man, what a bummer. Like, we're, you know, whatever my investment was, you know, whether I thought I was going to be here short-term or long-term, a decision point is being forced upon me of what am I going to have to do next when this is all over.
Okay, I got something. I'm ready.
Okay,
let's go.
Good,
let's go.
Good, great.
Man, Carl. Man.
Yeah, no, I
no,
know.
No, no.
Joe, I know.
Carl.
I know, Joe.
Carl.
Joe.
Carl.
Joe.
Carl.
Joe.
Carl.
Joe, don't.
Please,
don't
Carl.
Yell at, don't yell at me.
I'm not yelling at you.
Okay.
Okay, cool.
It's the there's no reason to turn
I'm
against
just,
each other.
Yeah, you're right. You're totally right.
The Indians are our problem.
Yes, you're right.
Huh?
You're absolutely
yeah,
right.
I know.
Yeah.
Okay.
But I wouldn't say it in there. Carl,
no,
I would
I
not
know.
Say it in there.
No, I'm
okay?
not going to march in there and go, you know what the problem is?
Oh,
the Indians.
Cool.
Okay,
they can hear. They got the door open, Carl.
Okay.
They're giving us a couple minutes, okay?
Okay.
To clear out our stuff.
Yeah, I know.
Just be cool, all right?
Okay.
This
I'll
is
be cool.
Very, like, you know, I get very intense about this kind of stuff.
Oh, yeah, well, it's that's totally appropriate. We're losing our jobs.
I know.
Shh. I'm 52 years old.
I'm 48.
Sir, you're a spring chicken.
I know. I expected to spend my whole life here.
Yeah, well, me too. I was going to just coast into retirement. But now it looks like I got to be out on the street and figure out what the hell I'm going to do with myself next.
But the thing I like about you is
oh.
you don't get down like I do.
Well, I have a different way of showing it. You know, I mean, I'm down. I feel bad. I feel really bad. But, you know.
That's funny. You this is what you do, man. Every time that I get stressed out, you always, like, make me laugh.
Yeah, come on.
Yeah.
Chin up. You have 4 additional years of life to do what you will with it.
Huh? That's what
That's
I love.
That's the funny side.
Yeah, I love that, yeah. man. I can't do that stuff. I'm always, like, so, like, you know, hey, I'm getting fired. What am I going
to
do?
Yeah, no, I know. Well, you know, you have a right to feel that. Just go ahead and feel that, okay?
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm going to take this stapler and smash it.
Yeah, that will show someone something.
Yeah. You know what?
Smash a stapler. Make
yeah.
them feel it.
Ah!
Yeah, no, that's
ah,
good.
That feels good. That
ah!
Feels...
Ah! Oh, hey, guys. So you got your desk all cleaned up?
Yeah, we did. Hey,
okay.
Let me just get that stapler. Bob, I'm sorry about that.
It's fine. I realize that it's a difficult day for you fellas.
Yeah.
I mean, I know that we're ending our relationship with you, but I want you to know how much you've meant to the company.
Thank you, Bob.
You're welcome.
Yeah.
You're welcome.
I'm just gonna close the door.
Yeah, your friend hightailed it over the other
yeah,
side
I know.
Of the room.
What the? What were you doing, man? You left.
I don't know. I don't know.
I was there for like 5 minutes.
I realized it was more of a dramatic entrance than I wanted to make.
You saw
who kicks in a door?
You ran around the desk and then came back out here.
I know. It's a real Wile E. Coyote.
Yeah.
Oh.
Man.
Hey.
But that was cool, man.
It was cool.
That was really cool.
I know, I felt like a badass. Why don't you come to my basement and drink some beers with me?
I told you.
Come on.
I told you no.
This is our last chance
know,
to drink some beers in my basement.
No. You know the last time?
Yeah, that was cool.
Well, Sheila didn't think it was cool.
Well.
When she had to bail me out of jail.
Yeah, well, okay.
Yeah.
I know I said otherwise to those cops, but I do think there was a ghost in there. So.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know what Sheila said?
That's why I started firing the fireworks in the basement, because I was like, oh, we're going to bust a ghost.
Sheila said there's no such thing as ghosts.
Yeah, well, you know, your wife should allow you to dream and acknowledge the fantastic.
Are you saying that I don't dream?
No, I'm saying you do dream, and then your wife crushes those dreams.
Okay.
And it's the prime dysfunctional element of your relationship.
Okay.
I'm saying come to my basement, let's butt up against the doorway to another world.
Okay.
And, you know, just...
I'm down. Let's
Great,
do it.
Good.
Let's do it.
Yeah, we should
celebrate,
right?
I'm
going
to have to call Sheila.
Let me call her.
Okay. Okay.
It'll just be easier if it's...
Great.
Hello, I'm calling Joe's residence.
Hi, this is Sheila.
Oh, hi, Sheila. Good. You were who I was trying to reach. I'm with Joe right now.
Oh, are you?
Yes.
Is he in some sort of trouble?
Well, oh, geez. You know what I realized?
Because you don't call unless he's in some sort of trouble there.
Here's something I realized. He may not have confided in you that he is losing his job today.
What the? What are you doing?
What
are you doing?
What?
You're not talking. What?
I'm sorry. It just all fell into place.
That's between a man and a wife. I'm supposed to tell her.
Okay. Let me call her back.
Okay.
Hello?
Hello, Sheila.
Why did you hang up on me?
I slipped. I slipped and fell down, embraced myself with the telephone. Which
is Joe there?
He
is Joe
is,
in trouble? Are you calling from the police?
No, I'm not calling the police. Joe's fine. We're working. I have insisted that he come over to my house today because we recently received a certificate for excellent work in our employment, and we deserve to celebrate. It seems like things are a little shaky on the horizon, so maybe the situation will change. But what I said to you earlier was a prank in order to break the ice and let you let Joe come to my house.
Well, he's got to be home by 9 o'clock tonight.
Oh, he will be.
Or I'm holding you responsible.
I'm comfortable with that.
What is she saying? What is she saying? What is she saying?
You're good.
Okay, cool, cool.
Oh, it's just, well, she got the message.
Oh, you just hung up on her?
Yeah.
You can't do that.
Well, I've done it twice already. What, a third time and a genie appears? I'm sorry. I'm being glib, but I'm just excited. You know, I'm excited.
I'm excited too.
Okay, great.
I'm really excited.
Let's get down in my basement and drink those beers, you know? We'll
look forward to the basement, man.
Yeah.
Well, you've done a lot of stuff since I've been here.
Yeah, I changed a few things around. The ambient light of Christmas lights, I find, is, you know, makes everything feel warmer.
Yeah, it feels like Christmas, man. I feel like singing, you know?
Yeah, it feels like Christmas in the basement.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You want to sing?
Sure.
Oh, holy night, the stars are brightly shining. It is the night of the light of our Lord. Check out his Mustang, it is truly bitching. Get out the road.
You're a good friend, you know that?
Yeah, you're a great friend. I'm gonna miss not having every day with you.
I am too.
Hairs on the back of your neck just stand up?
Yeah. Think it's a ghost?
I know it's a ghost.
All right. That was a blast. All right, so tell me.
I know, I'm sorry that like I can be a little schizophrenic.
I love that. I love that. And I bet your team loves playing because it really forces them to have to like justify and make it into a scene. But you're just great. So what did you like about that?
Oh, well, I thought it was really free, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, it was free, but at its heart was kind of like this a relationship between two guys that I thought sincerely liked each other.
Yeah.
I mean, that's something that I talk about a lot, and I really believe is that, you know, there's this notion, I think some people even teach it, that like conflict is the engine of action, and I rarely find that to be the case, you know, especially to start a scene, because it feels like, oh well, what we're getting into is just making up a laundry list of reasons that are fake for why I'm right or you're right, right?
Right.
But to actually have sort of a communal sense of togetherness. Well, can permit conflict because we care about each other more than what we're fighting about, and so we want to make things work out. So, being those two guys, I just felt like, well, we're in a stressful situation, you know, and we may wind up lashing out at each other occasionally because of the stress of that situation. But we are together, and we're experiencing the same thing. You know, the status is shared. Mm-hmm. You know, which.
So,
I like.
What do you think made it work right from the beginning?
Emotional investment.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So we both started with the emotional investment. I'm like, oh my God, we can't believe that. We got fired.
Yeah, that we got fired. That we're being outsourced.
Right.
You know? Which I thought was interesting, and I enjoyed it because that was kind of an elevation of stakes that that I didn't necessarily expect. You know, kind of with that premise. You know, and again, I don't think premise will save you. So that's why I like doing scenes. Mm-hmm. It's like your concept can be whatever the hell it's going to be, but. The moment, I mean, of, I thought going into that scene that we were going to be like the last guys in the office, but still in the office.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact that it was an elevation of stakes of like, oh no, we are now outsourced and we're going into the other room to like check out and leave.
Right.
Was like, it was a surprise extra level of immediacy that I didn't expect that kind of goosed me to get going.
Well, I think what I enjoyed that you made me, because... One part I was like, okay, be cool, which I've played a million times before. I played in my sleep. And then you were just like, okay, I forget. I was just, I'm going to drop this because whatever you're doing is more fun. Let's just go with that. You know? So it was.
Well, I'm sorry if I railroaded. That's what.
No, I didn't. I didn't experience you railroading.
Okay,
I experienced you threw something out. And then, you know, you would, if you felt you were going too far. You were going to call yourself on it, and I felt that we found agreement through it.
Yeah, I mean that's really, you know, it's a scene that I enjoyed playing, like all the scenes that I really enjoyed playing, where like it kind of architecture went away. You know, we sort of roughly had a context of who we were and what we were doing, and then after that, it was just a state of play where it was like, oh, there's the folks in the other room, and we have been yelling, so may as well get them involved and just see where that
goes. Well, that was a great move when you then became Bob, our boss.
Yeah.
You know? And then we came back and we had this moment. And then me making you call my wife, or you
just
call
really, your wife. Yeah, I was so happy you became Sheila, because I was.
Well, like, you gave me permission, because I'm like, okay, if Jorn's going to play Bob, that means I'm going to have to, in this forum, the Jimmy and Jorn forum,
right.
Which they'll be doing at CIC on Thursdays. But I'm like, okay, I'm gonna, right, so. great. I've got to be the voice. So that gave me permission to do it.
Yeah, and I mean that connection I thought was really enjoyable too. To sort of like slide into these peripheral points of view that we were playing kind of let us. I think when we came back to sort of being together, it kind of let us have our connection be a little bit stronger, because, you know, the exterior folks that we played were either kind of like cold or adversarial. Mm-hmm. So like to actually have that as a juxtaposition by how these two guys connect, even though they're sort of like strange dudes. It was pretty great.
Great. So we're going to take some questions. Anything else you want to say about what we just did?
I enjoyed it a lot. I really
would you have done anything differently? Any choices?
You know, yeah, probably. If we had improvised it 5 minutes later, I would have done everything differently.
Okay.
But there is nothing that I would have cared to edit going back. I feel great about it as like an expression of play.
You're not one of those people that overanalyzes after they do a show.
Well, I mean, I probably am, mm-hmm. but it's much more, because I think critical observance of whatever you do or see is really important. But I also am like not going to be a hard on about it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like for this experience, I think that our acknowledgement of the things that worked is just as valuable as breaking things down. You know, if as a scene it primarily worked and was composed of positive, successful things, then your critical eye should absorb those positive things so they can serve as lessons for how to behave in the future. And I feel like we effectively did that. Mm-hmm. Like anything that was kind of a degree of like messiness or, you know, like sort of craziness, I think would be nitpicking compared to the success of it, right? I mean, like these people seem to really enjoy it.
Yeah.
And that's not, you can't always say, oh, if the audience likes it, it's good. But to me, it felt good. It seemed like they liked it. All empirical evidence points to it being good, right? So.
All right. Okay, let's take some questions from the audience about what we just did or about Jorn. Yes.
You say you divide your time mainly between 40-hour a week job and improv, and that can take up a lot. Do you cut time out to relax and do something aside from those two?
I've got to repeat this question just for the podcast. What do you do in terms of time to relax? You're working 40 hours a week. You're teaching. How do you have time for relaxing? What do you do?
If I have a weekend day, I crash on my couch and read comic books while a terrible movie's on in the background. You know, so that's fairly energizing. And then, you know, I have a couple nights a week, Tuesdays now, if I haven't booked something else, where I get to spend time with my girlfriend, you know, and we'll, you know, kind of have that be our chance to catch up. She's also an artist and an actor, so she lives a similarly crazy schedule. And so that time together where we can kind of, you know, consume media and food and each other's presence is really re-energizing. You know, very, very thankful to have that too.
Great. Another question? Yeah, right here.
Yeah. How often do you watch improv now?
As much as I can.
How often do you watch improv?
I'm sorry. I should do it too. How often do I watch improv? Absolutely as much as I can, because I do think that, you know, I think that's part of like the veteran malaise thing of like you suddenly are like, oh, I'm doing something different than everyone else, so I won't watch shows. It's cool for me to just goof off in a back room. You know, it's like that's, you're just trying to get worse if you do that. So I try and watch every team that I open for or opens for me. And if I have a free night, you know, I'll certainly try and get to the showcase at CIC because I know I'll see stuff that really impresses me there, you know. And really that's, you know, it's I know that like sort of the first group of level three students that I taught are getting into their 5B shows right now. And I don't know that my schedule is going to work out, but it is like in my mind as something that, you know, I want to go and see their shows and see how they're doing and see if they're still true believing or if the system has crushed them or not, you know.
So. Great. Another question? Right here.
Hi.
So you see a lot of shows both inside and outside of the actual set. Are there any like super annoying habits that you see that keep happening over and over?
What are the super annoying habits you keep seeing over and over?
Well,
in teams,
I think it's more of a there's a kind of a couple things I think that just philosophically, and it's just a philosophical alignment that is different from my own. But you know, I think that there is you see, especially on especially with ensembles that are trying to that are maybe nervous about themselves or trying to produce an effect. You see a lot of writing and not a lot of listening. Like their improvisation is they're treating it like they're trying to write jokes. You know, and there's no emotional presence and no opportunity to sort of like react and mutate within shows, and it produces all these shows that like really aren't that good, but they sort of they have all the signifiers of being the work, but none of the content of the work, and that bums me out and drives me a little bit crazy. And then you know, kind of we're in a real like sort of flush of kind of Dada and absurdist play, which. Obviously, I love the absurd, but it can be completely emotionally unrooted where it's enough to just be sort of ridiculous and, you know, so be like French annoyance theater of like we're just going to keep challenging you with things that have no anchor to reality and you'll laugh because that's what's funny now. And there's some people that are great at it, but it is inducing an entire generation of people to perform that way.
Is what you're talking about is acting and being more grounded in a scene? You can still be crazy and whatever.
Yeah,
but,
I think it's emotional content. You know, whether it's over intellectual or whether it is absurd, there's the donut hole that tends to happen where people forget to be human beings, whether they're absurd human beings or not. And that's what I really like to see.
Now, when you improvise, you say you love how your brain feels when you're doing it.
Yeah, absolutely.
How did your brain feel after doing this?
Oh, great. It's flooded with serotonin, you know?
Okay.
It's like, that was a great time. You know, I enjoyed like, you know, shifting my internal dimension to be a slightly different person in that time. And I'll carry a piece of that person with me, you know? So it gives me a little bit more like richness. Like it's... The media that we're working in, I feel like, is empathy. I got to be a slightly different person for myself, and now I feel better about people.
What do you mean the medium we're working in is empathy?
I mean that when we, you know, what we are working in, ideally, I think, is that when we perform, rather than, you know, than sculpting with clay or painting with oil paints, we are using the immaterial substance of empathy if we're being effective. We're crafting our personas, and we're, you know, grabbing the stuff out of the ether that will make us understand each other better. You know, we will have understanding of other people if we, you know, craft our piece such that we, you know, take care of someone that is slightly away from us. And if we do that effectively in front of other people, then they will feel that too. And the, you know, the sort of like etheric ice sculpture that manifests is composed of feeling together.
This has been awesome. This has been really, really fun.
Yeah, I feel like
our last question, what piece of advice would you give to an improviser starting out today?
You're probably right when you see things. So, like, develop your critical eye. I get concerned that I'm encouraging people to judge things, but I'm just saying that you have worth, and what you see should shape what you think. So if you see something and everyone says it's good, but you think it's kind of bad, you're probably right. Figure out why it's kind of bad and why, what that can do to help you change your point of view. If you think something is great and other people are not aware of it, you're also probably right. Figure out why it's great and allow that to influence you. You know, I mean, like, you're on your journey by yourself. Like, take care of yourself and don't cede, you know, don't cede your awareness to someone who is outside of you. It is within you. Craft it as much as you can.
Beautiful. Thank you so much.
Absolutely.
And there you have it. Another episode of Improv Nerd is in the can. And I want to thank our guest, Joran Gargello. And I loved improvising with him. And didn't he really pull me out of my comfort zone? And that, honestly, that's not an easy thing to do, because I always get into the Mr. Serious and deep and whatever improv. I want to thank Stage 773. They're our home base here. They're the people that treat us like such rock stars. My producer, Dan Schiffmacher, he's the one who makes me sound so slick and so professional. If it wasn't for Dan, you would not be hearing my voice right now. If you want more information about me, Jimmy Corain, and my award-winning improv classes and workshops, the Artist Low Comedy, and to sign up for the Improv Nerd blog, all you need to do is go to jimmycorain.com. We're also taking over social media, but we're doing it very subtly, very secretly, I guess. Find us on Facebook, Improv Nerd, and like us. Then follow us at improv_nerd, and then check out our YouTube channel. We have tons of great clips. That's Improv Nerd Podcast. Speaking of podcasts, we are part of a podcast collective called Feral Audio. Check out all their wonderful podcasts at feralaudio.com. I'd like to thank our sponsor today, Dad's Garage in Atlanta. And don't forget to use that Improv Nerd code to save 25% off any improv show. And of course, I want to thank you for listening, because without you, this is just a waste of my time. And until next time, remember, walk, don't run.
Hello, I'm Dave Ross.
Hey, and I'm Hampton Yunt.
And we host Suicide Buddies on Starburns Audio.
That's right. It's a podcast about suicide, but not to make light of it. We actually talk about suicidal thoughts, depression, kind of with a sense of levity that Dave and I have with each other. He's my best friend. Come on.
Yeah, we're buddies. Suicide Buddies.
That's the title.
One of our favorite episodes that we've recorded so far is about this guy, Jan Pataki, who was a Polish aristocrat in the 19th century. Mm-hmm. And he, one of the reasons it's possible that he killed himself is that he thought he was a werewolf.
Oh.
Check out a clip. It also makes me think, like, we were talking about in the Norway black metal episode, how, like, just the culture of your surroundings can affect you. Like, yeah. He's in a castle in Poland. He's like, I mean, if you lived in a castle in Poland and no one knew anything about anything, you might be like, I'm a bat. I'm probably a bat.
That's like literally what happened to Batman. He literally is in his mansion. He's like, you know what? Fuck it. I'm a bat.
I'm a bat. I'm a bat.
I'm a
bat that helps people.
I'm a bat that helps people.
I'm a rich...
I don't know what you want from me. And my girlfriend, she's a cat.
My girlfriend's a cat.
She steals things. She's a woman who steals things. She's a cat. I'm a bat.
I'm a bat. I help people. She's a cat. We fight a penguin.
My